Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Listen. Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. And, you know, I've had some pretty impressive guests. And today is no different. It's the 162nd episode of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat. And really, I've got a New York Times best-selling author who's written more than 30 novels. He's been called a hard-boiled poet, a noir poet laureate. He's won Audis and Barrys and McCavities and Anthony Awards. But what's actually insane is that in the midst of conducting this epic analysis and deep dive minute by minute into Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus, the man that I'm about to speak to has actually been writing this Heat prequel / sequel novel. That man is the insanely talented and insanely prolific Reid Farrell Coleman. Reid, thank you so much for being part of One Heat Minute.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. I think insane is the right word. not insanely prolific, not insanely talented, just insane.
Well, look, from a person who's definitely been called insane during this project, from one insane person to another, welcome. I'm so glad that we could link up. Thank you so much for agreeing to be a part of the show. There's so much I want to pick your brain about. Obviously, we're not going to go and spoil your entire novel that you've been working deeply on, but I think that your insights and just your, you know, your familiarity with these hard-boiled, broken, but ultimately kind of rigidly moral characters is going to be fascinating, I think, when you strip it right back down to what, you know, this, the 162nd minute is, and even what the last sort of 9 minutes of this movie in its completion are, which is these really elemental cat and mouse chase, predator versus prey, and, you know, instincts writ large on the cinema screen, all of its visual language, not much talking, but you as a guy who's designing narrative constantly, it's going to be fun to chat to you about this, and particularly with your insights of working with the man. So I'm sure we'll dive into that. But just before we get started, let's Reid and I dive into the minute now, so we can watch together. You guys are going to listen along, and then once we're done, we're going to come back and talk about it. And just in case this is your very first episode of One Heat Minute, it is the 162nd minute. So welcome. You've got some catching up to do. Only 161 to catch up on before the next last final few drops. So you've got a bit of catching up to do. But if you are listening along and you're trying to sync it up, this is the, it'll say 2 hours, 41 minutes on your dial for this next 60 seconds. And then finish up at 2 hours, 42. The challenge that you've got is there's a director's definitive edition out, which is slightly seconds out from what we're watching. So if you have the old classic Warner Brothers Blu-ray, you're exactly on point where we're going to be watching. But we're going to watch it now. You guys can listen up, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Thank you.
There we have it. Chasing your own shadow, white noise, paranoia, and just after all the grandiosity of this movie, I can just never get over that it turns into this beautiful mano-a-mano face-off in this kind of alien, weird alien landscape, in alien slash industrial landscape, Reed.
Yes, well, I'll just listen. I think you've got this down pat. Just listen to you talk about it.
I think people have had enough of me talking about it, to be honest, probably by now. If this is their 162nd minute of Michael Mann's 95 crime episode, they've had enough of me talking. They want to hear from you, my friend. They want to hear from you.
Well, this minute is particularly fascinating for me on a personal level, not only the amazing technical aspects of how Michael is such a great, and now I'm no film guy. I'm just a film fan.
Yes.
But the amazing tension he builds there by the way he shoots that scene.
Yes.
Is just to, you know, a layman, pretty amazing. But on a personal level, it's amazing because, as I think I've told you, I worked at the cargo area at Kennedy Airport for 5 years.
Yes.
So that is it. Yes. So any of the listeners who've seen Goodfellas, those are the guys I worked with for 5 years. They were all named Vinny.
And they were all planning their own Lufthansa heists one after the other.
Oh, yeah. They all fancied themselves, you know, real tough guys. So that's an amazing kind of, you know, happenstance that I was somebody who worked at the cargo area at Kennedy Airport and very familiar with that kind of milieu, the part of the airport people don't often see.
Yes.
It's kind of like in a restaurant, the back of the house and the front of the house.
Yes.
I got to see the back of the house, so I'm very familiar with that. But really what's fascinating about this minute is how you summed it up. It's kind of a shadow dance, one man with his own shadow. And it, to me, is the physical expression of the conversation that the two of them have in their face-to-face meeting in the coffee shop.
Yes.
In the coffee shop, they talk about it. And in this minute, and from here to the end of the movie, they live it.
Yes.
And so it's a really interesting there's a lot of foreshadowing in books. It's something I'm fairly familiar with.
Yes.
And it's often subtle in books. And in movies, it's less subtle. I mean, we all know the famous example of if you see a gun in scene one, you know somehow in the denouement, the gun is going to be used. Or
yes.
If the cell phone doesn't work early on in the movie, at the end of the movie, it's that cell phone not working is going to be part of the denouement.
It's going to be part of the character's demise, very likely.
Right.
Very likely.
Yes. So here you have them in the coffee shop having this face-to-face meeting where they're both kind of looking in the mirror.
Yes.
Which is really what's going on. They're looking in the mirror at each other. And the way it's shot, you know, that's an interesting thing, the scene in the coffee shop. I know that's not my minute, but I have to refer to it.
You're allowed listen, Reed, you know, right. For someone who hasn't listened to every episode, what we do, we're exactly like Neil McCauley. We say we've got this discipline, and then we break it over and over and over again.
Right. And so here it is, that shadow dance that they talked about and keeping their word.
Yes.
These are guys who keep their word.
Yes.
And so here they are keeping their word. This is what I said in the coffee shop I would do. And here we are. This is what I'm doing.
Yes.
So I think that's why this is a fascinating moment, other than the brilliant way it's shot and the tension and the, you know, what's strange is, okay, we could have had it be a old style Western showdown.
Yeah.
Right? Two guys in the middle of the street at noon. But here, there's that other element, that technology element, the lights, the sounds of the jets, the kind of weird, as you put it, industrial kind of strange setting, which heightens the tension a thousandfold. Could you imagine? You could have shot this scene, I imagine, in a warehouse.
Yeah.
A quiet warehouse where they're the only two people. But it would have – the tension – there would have been tension, obviously, just because it's the two of them. But the noise, the lights, the buildings, the shadow adds so much to it.
Yeah,
that,
I think you're spot on it. It's like this whole other layer of uncertainty, like in a warehouse. And even you don't have to be a film expert. You can be a film fan to talk about it. Is we're so programmed, us as viewers, like in a quiet warehouse, because of the way they've been used in cinema. It's like every creak, every like rattling of a chain, every something like that. Like it's going to have us in a heightened state for like noise. But here, you know, grass can move and they can thump against one of these weird concrete outcroppings, and the lights will go and change the whole dimension of what we're viewing, and the airplanes roaring, you know, and then this sort of deathly quiet and can hush over. It's all that unpredictability. I think you're so spot on. It's just like all these other elements that are happening. It just doesn't, it would not be the same if it was a quiet street or in stark sunlight. It's like the fact that it's all these things at once it's what's really special.
Yes. Now here's some insight. I mean, I can't give you too much insight into, you know, Michael's way of thinking.
Please don't.
Or as I think of him, Mr. Man.
and as we do too, Mr. Man.
Yes. Is one of Michael's, I think, favorite movies is Godfather 2, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Just so happens to star these two guys.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we refer back to that movie, which I think Michael does in his heart, even if not consciously, and this is total speculation, Michael has talked to me about Godfather 2. I think he loves that movie.
Yes.
But the scene early on in Godfather 2 where the senator is in Michael's office.
Hmm.
And I've seen that movie once or twice.
I bet also. I bet you. I have too.
And Michael Corleone says to the senator, let's not pretend we're not part of the same hypocrisy.
Yes.
You know.
Beautiful.
To me, there's a resonance with the coffee shop scene in Heat and in this minute.
Yes.
And how the rest of the movie plays out. We are who we are, and let's not pretend we are not. And one of the things that was odd for me is I've written bad guys in the past.
Yes.
But I mostly write good guys.
Yes.
And so one of the things I've had to struggle with and learn is how to see these guys as the heroes.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing to do that. And, you know, Al Pacino, the Hannah, is not a he's a good guy, but he isn't a classic.
No.
Good guy.
Very far from it.
He's a hunter. He's a classic hunter. He's not a classic hero at all. Because look at his family life.
Yes.
What a mess.
And he's just left it all behind too, Reed. He's like sprinted out of there, skipped away from the chaos.
Right. Kicked the TV screen, kicked the TV set out of the car.
Yes.
Again, sorry, I'm referring to someone else's minute. Don't shoot me. No, you know, that symbolic thing of kicking the TV out of the car. You know, oh, screw it. I'm going to leave this behind, you know, and, you know, as I'm writing, since I've written, obviously it's a prequel. So I've written Hannah earlier.
Yes.
And let's just say that he's never been really good. If you know, I'm sorry if I'm jumping around a little bit here, but when, Nate is telling Macaulay in the car about Hannah. You know, he talks about his divorces.
Yes.
And Chicago, which is where some of the prequels going to take place.
Oh, my
goodness.
Let's
just say Hannah, Vincent Hannah's never been really had wonderful marital relationship.
I can imagine. So, I can in my wildest imaginings of this movie, there's one thing that I've never ever thought is that he was a great partner. None of these guys.
Yeah. He's a great partner if you're a cop, but
yes,
marital status
not
wise,
a marital partner.
Yeah.
No.
Oh no, no way. So you know, and what else is really interesting for me to have to learn is I think Michael sees them in the way you describe them as pure, kind of that they're very pure. They are who they are.
Yes.
And interestingly, they make some choices towards the end of the movie, particularly Macaulay, in which are, and I think this is a really interesting question that viewers struggle with is, you know, Macaulay could have gotten on and had a wonderful life.
Of course.
The life that Hannah could never have.
Yeah.
Hannah could never have that because he's Hannah. He could never have that life. And Macaulay, and it's, I think, you know, here's Michael being a brilliant filmmaker. I hope you're listening, Michael. is the exit. He could go one way in the car or the other way in the car. I mean, I don't think that's an accident that he does that. And he goes to the hotel to exact revenge. And that's, to me, is also very – sorry I'm stepping on everybody else's minutes, but I just don't think
– You're working with Mr. Man on fleshing out our whims and our dreams and our fantasies about what these characters – how these characters came to be and how these characters came to this landscape. And so we'll give you as much permission to trample – this close to the end, all over those other minutes. But I think you're so right. It's, you know, they have, that's, I wrestle with that too. And I've seen this movie as many times as any other human being has seen it in the world, perhaps almost as many times as Mr. Michael Mann's editors saw it in actually putting it together. And one of the things that really that sticks with me and I really was resonating with me as you were talking, Reed, is like, there's such a wrestle, like it's a maddening wrestle between him just going. And so many times Hannah, the way that Hannah talks is like, he's gone. Neil is gone. Right. Bye-bye. He's gone. Like they lay all the traps. They throw the Hail Marys. There's no way he's going to be there. He's gone. He's too smart. He's too good. And it's that weird hierarchy in his brain that says revenge is more important than escape.
And this is the interesting thing is I'm not sure Michael sees it as revenge. I think Michael sees, and this is my guess. Yeah. We've had some talks about it, but he sees it as his loyalty to, now, you know, Chirito's dead. There's nothing you can do about it. You walk, you go in the rain, you get wet, right? Yeah. He knew his risk.
I'll tell you what I don't you do. Know, so, I'll tell you what I don't do, Reed. I don't sell medals is one of my other favorite lines of Neil McCauley.
It's stress fractures and titanium. So what you don't see here is I don't think Michael sees this as pure revenge.
No.
I think he sees it as, you know, justice in a way.
Yeah.
I don't think he Macaulay is the type of guy who just – sees things as I'm going to get him back for that,
and it's like order. It's also order and control. Like it's justice and it's order, because it's like this is an element that's out of place. Like there's nothing more. You know, if you were to talk about a word that describes Wangro in this movie, you know, the big, you know, there's obviously Chris Chehalis, which is the other like male, you know, part of this trinity, if you like, of you know key characters, but But Wayne Grow is like pure chaos. Like he's just pure chaos. And he's, you know, backing himself, you know, I'm a cowboy, I like anything heavy. You know, he knows that there's danger coming for him. He knows there's potentially reprisal for all the bad things that he's done, but he doesn't care. He's just still chaotic. He's just playing everything as it lays. Every hand is all in. And, you know, the chips fall as they may.
Yeah, I think I see it the same way, is that Macaulay sees order in the universe. Mm. It may not be the same order we see in the universe.
Yeah, yeah.
And in some ways, he's restoring order to the universe, even if it means he doesn't get to do the thing he wants to do.
Yes.
It's as if that he needs to be the one to blot out or sand out the blemish in the metal of the scheme of things.
Yes.
That in some ways he's the leader of the crew. Wayne, and this is something Michael and I have never really fully talked about, because you just have to accept the movie as it is.
Yes.
Right? Would Macaulay have ever let a guy like Wayne Grow into the crew if he knew he would just be an element of chaos?
No.
So in some ways, this is not revenge. This is Macaulay taking responsibility for unleashing, you know, he opened Pandora's box. He has to be the one to close it. You know, even if he was on the other side of the world in, you know, New Zealand looking at bioluminescent algae, which, by the way, he's talking about in the house overlooking the lights of LA flashing beneath him, as if
which look themselves like bioluminescent algae.
Less, right, absolutely. So I think he feels responsible,
yeah,
as he felt for his crew. He feels responsible for closing Pandora's box, and in this movie, in these people's lives, that Pandora's box is Wayne Grow.
Yes.
And he does. He closes Pandora's box at the cost of his own life and his own happiness.
Yeah. Order
if
is
he
more.
If he was really right, he restores order.
Yes.
More than vengeance.
Yes.
See, I had to learn that actually, because like most viewers, I think your first viewing of this movie, you see it as pure vengeance.
Yes.
But it isn't.
I think that's what
came to that.
That's what grabs us, though, Reed. I think that what you talk about in like a insanely awesome firsthand experience of like wrestling with these characters is what I think preliminarily brings the super fans back for their first taste. It's like there's something that's something that niggles at you. It's not pure vengeance. So you go back and you watch it again and it feels completely different. You know, whatever mood you're in, whatever, you know, if you watch this in an angry mood, you know, it's vengeance. If you watch this in a really righteous mood and you don't like Wayne Grow, you want vengeance exacted. And then in this, like, when you can sort of watch it more objectively, as we're talking about it, it's an order restoration. And then you go, okay, this movie is a mutating force in some weird ways, right? That's part of it's got this clarity, but there's this great thing that just allows you to just continue to tangle with it, with these characters, because they allow some ambivalence and a bit of ambiguity in some of their decisions that they're making. And you get to float between them and have these great gaps of, you know, how am I going to pour myself into this? How am I going to view it this time?
Well, what's very interesting, here's a little more happenstance and serendipity. Last week, a noir writer friend of mine named William Boyle, if you've never read him, you should. He's from my old neighborhood in Brooklyn. He's very dark writer, really interesting, and he teaches, I believe, at the University of Mississippi in Oxford. And he's a very good guy. He did an interview with this writer you may have heard of, Don Winslow.
Yes. Another manhead and another great writer, and
right,
big trilogy of books that are killing it at the moment.
Yeah, so here's the serendipity. So the one of the first questions Bill asks Don, who's an old friend, and we're both represented by the same agent. Don, they ask about, are you a Goodfellas guy or a Heat guy? right? Two classic, crime movies, and obviously I have a certain attachment to both of these movies.
Of course. It's the Sophie's choice of questions to open an interview, to be brutally honest. You know, it's tough.
So Don, of course, says he loves Goodfellas, but what he said about Heat is exactly what you got done saying before I went rambling on, was that for him it's Heat because he always sees something different in the movie every time he watches it.
Yes.
So you're not alone. There's at least two people on earth who feel exactly the same way that you do. Oh. And the other guy is Don Winslow.
That's good company. That's good company to be in, Reed. That's good. Here's
the other bit of serendipity, and I'll shut up.
Please don't shut up. You keep going.
I did an essay for a blog called Crime Reads.
Yes.
I don't know if you, and it was about Bosch.
Yes.
Do you get Bosch?
I don't think Bosch is on Netflix here, but we have.
No, it's on Amazon. It's on Amazon.
Amazon Prime or something like that. Yeah.
Yes. I've known Michael for a long time and I love Bosch.
Yes.
And I did all, but one of the lines that in this essay is, and by the way, I've been working on the Heat prequel with Michael Mann, and here's a bit of serendipity within serendipity, is Edie's house in Heat is Bosch's house in the series.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
So there's something for your listeners and viewers that they might like to know.
Oh, that is so cool. That is an amazing tidbit.
Yes, so that those lights that are the bioluminescent lights of New Zealand, that is Los Angeles, in Bosch, you see them all the time. They're on the deck. That's one of the shots that's in almost every episode of Bosch, is that nighttime shot with L.A. spreading out. And it's great. So Michael Mann now owes me money for plugging Bosch.
Apart from everything else, apart from all your work on Heat. One of the things I want to talk to you about, you talked about foreshadowing before. And I think that earlier in this minute, one of the things that I really like, just from a pure performance perspective, and I just wanted to get your take on it, is there's a couple of moments where these guys do these sort of like, they both sort of leap around a corner expecting to see one another. And what's so weird just about the pacing and about the tension of the minute is when they don't see their shadow, when they don't see their reflection around the corner, the energy is still like crazy high. And I guess you as a writer, when you're imagining what a scene is, it's like when they leap around the corner and there's nothing there, there's still this heightened tension. And it feels like there's a death. What just happens at the end of this minute, just as we come to the finish line of 162, is like as soon as Neil actually catches Vincent's shadow, it feels like, and it's like the lights start to come down in the airplane. It's just all these elements are all happening at the same time. And then it becomes calm. So what I wanted to ask you as like a writer is like when you're doing that is like, and I know you play with these hard-boiled guys. Like is sometimes the anticipation of that acquisition of that thing that they're wanting, like and just not getting it or just not being there or just that subversion of expectations, like in a novel, how do you toy with that? Like it's a longer game, right? Like in cinema, it's just instant. It's like a reflex. We can see it. But how do you play with that as a novelist? Because I think it's still such an incredible storytelling, like in an instant in cinema, but in a novel, it's, I'd love to pick your brain.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting differences in working with somebody who's a filmmaker and a screenwriter.
Yes.
But those are very different talents, and they're very different arts.
Yes.
You know, in a movie, I will often talk about this at when I do book signings and stuff, and it comes up that I'm writing this book, is, you know, you have a soundtrack.
Yes.
In a movie. You have music in a movie.
Yes.
You have shifting points of view in a movie. You have all sort of acting. You have facial expression. You have, I have none of that, right? So what you play with in your head is, at least, and I don't speak for all writers, trust me, it's a good thing I don't speak for writers, is me, I actually imagine it in my head as a movie.
Yes.
And then think, does that translate? Can I make that work in words on the page?
Yes.
Because I do think I do good fight sequences. I think I do good shootout sequences. And silence is always, or stillness is always a part. Because I think that's a really smart move on Michael's part. You know, listen to me tell, oh, well, I think Michael was smart to do that, right? You know, which is part of the absurdity of this, you know, is I'm some schmuck from Coney Island in Brooklyn, and there's Michael Mann, you know, and we're collaborating on this. And it just seems, when I think about that, it just seems bizarre. To me, you know
that, I don't think it's bizarre. And one of the things I wanted to say is, when we've been talking, and Reed and I had a great convo that was not recorded, that should have been, which is a blast, before talking to you, so you guys can hear now. But I just want to say, as a great Bostonian film critic, who's increasingly a great friend of the show, and increasingly one of my favorite critics to read, by the name of Sean Burns. And Sean saw Heat in 95. When it came out, he saw it with his friends, college friends, I believe. And it was December, so it was winter in New York City. And he discussed on the show, you know, many episodes ago, that how foreign it was at the time to see a poster that had Al Pacino's face on it and Robert De Niro's face. And it, underneath it said, like, an LA crime saga. And people were like, LA? Like, these guys are the most New York guys ever. Like, in the history of movies. And I remember not having that, not feeling that, because I wasn't as, you know, I'm a little bit younger, so I wasn't as familiar with their bodies of work. And obviously, that, like, the quintessential, like, you know, icons of New York that they are. So I think a guy from, you know, Coney Island, Brooklyn, maintaining the sort of, I don't know, this weird middle distance with this transient space like LA, but keeping the sort of, you know, the big city New York perspectives is probably perfect. It's probably why Michael Mann's collaborating with you, because it's like he knows that these guys brought that energy into this much more, you know, into this wider expanse, as opposed to, you know, the normal, you know, condensed New York City bustle.
Well, that's a lovely thing of you to say. And if you want a job as my PR person, you're no, it is an interest, because Pacino and De Niro are the quintessential New York actors.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, the first time I actually met Michael Mann in person was at De Niro's hotel restaurant in Tribeca. So
And Tribeca's on Tribeca's on right now. You know, it's so
And Harvey Weinstein, by the way, was at the next table.
Oh man.
So that was strange. I mean they are the quintessential New York actors.
Yeah.
It's, don't ask me, you know, how this all happened. It's not worth thinking about, but you know, now that I'm in the midst of it, I'm in the midst of it. So is there anything you'd like to ask me about the book? Maybe I'd be able to answer.
Well, just one thing, and there's no detail. It's that for the longest time, Reed, before, you know, I'm so lucky having done this show, the great great writer in his own right, Jedediah Ayres, you know, said, oh, my friend Reed is writing the Heat prequel novel. And I was like, holy shit, Jedediah, you need to introduce me to him. And so at the time, it's always been talked about as like a Heat prequel. And I guess like I'm not sure if it's like a misnomer or if there might be flash forwards. But in a recent interview Michael did with Bill Gabbieri, another great guest of this show, he talked about it being like a Heat prequel and sequel. So something that might dance between timelines. And so I guess without spilling anything more other than is that factually correct, is like, are we going to maybe see beyond what we've seen in Heat from a future perspective? And or is it purely prequel? Is that kind of a bit of a misnomer?
Who would I be to... Who am I to disagree with Michael Mann?
I love talking to you, Reed. I wish we'd done 10 episodes together. This is fun.
I think since Michael said it, I think that I'm not letting the cat out of the bag, in that I think we both started. Michael, you know, here's one of the things I learned early on about Michael. He is really smart.
Yeah.
He's really smart. We don't think alike. We have very different processes. I am sure he pulls his hair out thinking about how I do stuff. I don't have any hair to pull out. So, you know, but I think in the end it's going to work, because we both, I think, envision that it just as a prequel. If you know how everything is going to end up.
Yeah.
If we all knew how Game of Thrones was going to end, what would be the interest in watching? I mean, there'd be some interest in watching it, but really the thing that's driving the last season is kind of, but what really happens?
What really happens?
What's ultimately going to happen? So all you have to think about, and this is, here's a little tease, who's left alive?
Yep.
At the end of, where do they go? What do they do?
Yeah.
And is there foreshadowing there?
Oh man, Reed.
See, I knew that would frustrate you.
No, it doesn't frustrate me. It makes me giddy with excitement. To be brutally honest with you, it makes me excited because this is the stuff that after, you know, 161 recorded episodes of this show, that, you know, to Don Winslow's point, is so titillating about this film and the mythology, is that at the end of it, you are literally left thinking, you know, in a very recent episode, I think it's episode 157. So folks who are listening to this, if this isn't your first episode and you've been listening along, I spoke to a great Australian film critic, Joanna DiMattia, and we both talked about just like, occasionally stopping and going, what the hell happens to Charlene? You know, what does Charlene do from here? What does Edie do? Like, what the hell is the fallout from that moment? And so there's some, those little tendrils, those little threads that always happens in that. So that's great. And for me also, it's the same argument and frustration I have with the navel gazing of like Star Wars prequels, because you know what happens, and they're your favorite movies ever. And I think that's the brilliance of the movie that we started talking about much earlier in this podcast, of Godfather Part 2, which is that at the same time as being a prequel, it is a sequel. There's like this, there's this beautiful parallel universes that are happening at the same time in this, you know, gargantuan epic across different time periods with different, you know, political machinations and social issues and, you know, things that need to be contended with across both streams. And we get to draw the parallels as the audience together while informing everything that we love and expanding upon all the themes of like what is possibly one of the greatest movies of all time anyway. And so I think in the spirit of that, I maybe mentioned it once, which is like, if Reed Coleman's and Michael Mann's novel of Heat is going to be the Godfather Part 2 of the Heat universe, or at least aspirations to do so, I'm going to be a very, very happy camper as the host of this show. So I'm excited there. Can I ask you one question? You teased in my in my conversation with you. If and I'm not sure if you're at liberty to say, but like you teased me, and maybe we'll talk about it off air and just tease the hell out of everyone. I'll just stop recording right now so I can pick your brain about it. You teased me with the prospect of like, you know, when you and Michael are talking about this Heat prequel, and obviously you're going back to Vincent and Chicago, and you're talking about these young guys, and you being a visual mind, like it's impossible not to have this novel running as a movie in your mind projecting. You talked about like who he'd cast. Who's the cast?
Yes. Well, I think I didn't mean that as a teaser, though maybe I should take credit for it and say I perfectly meant that as a teaser, of course. And I knew you would bring it up. Don't you love how people in life, you know, there's all this stuff happens by coincidence and happenstance, and then they take credit for it.
Yes.
I don't know if your listeners are mystery readers, but you know this, that I was selected to take over the Jesse Stone series.
Yes.
For the late Robert B. Parker. And people always ask me about how that came about. And of course, I had my own explanation for it. And then when I really found out what it was, it was utterly different. And I won't bore your viewers or listeners with the story. But let's just say what I believed was the reason and what was the reason were vastly different. So I think the reason Michael sometimes says stuff like I could cast so-and-so is he can't help himself but think of this in terms of a movie.
Yes.
And I can't help myself but I imagine it as a movie but think of it as a book.
Yes.
So it's an interest, and that causes some tension, obviously.
Yes.
I mean, no any collaboration that's easy is probably not worth worth anything.
Yes.
There's got to be tension between, especially when you have people coming from such different perspectives. You know, as a guy who I look at writing the following way, and I always say this in interviews, is that I try, what's magical about reading is that I give the reader just enough information to make the movie in his or her own head.
Yes.
So that everybody's movie that from my books is a little bit different from everybody else's.
Yes.
And Mike is thinking visual, you know, moral, what people are going to see, the music they're going to hear, the shots he's going to use. So I just think that's how he sees things.
Yes.
So I know, I'm not sure. I mean, do I think he wants to make this into a movie? You bet your ass. I'm sure he and I bet you I want him to do it more than he wants to do it. I think he thinks that way because he always I think he projects stuff as a movie. And I didn't mean to use project as a pun.
Yes.
He just sees things that way. So when he says that, I think he means it, but just because that's how he sees things.
And so can you give us any of those names? Any of those names he's mentioned? How about sorry, what did you say?
For a price.
For a price. Well, yeah, well, we're paying. We're going to be paying shortly. that's the impossible thing that has happened once or twice on this show. I've talked about like, you know, and this being the amazing text that it is, it's like people are like, who would you recast if you remade it in 2019? And I have so much trouble even imagining two actors that have grown together who you've so desperately wanted to see on screen who are like just phenomenal performers, like out of sight, incredible, same generation. You know, they're contemporaries. They come from even the same, space. It's like they don't exist in the same way. I think it's easier to cast this movie if you did it again in like the 70s. Like it's an easier way to like cast it in 74. Like, yep,
yeah.
I can cast this movie earlier, even 80s. I can cast it in the 80s, but not quite beyond the 2000s. I don't know, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm lucky. Because I don't have to cast it.
Yes.
But I think in the 70s, of course, which I think is the golden age of film in certain ways.
I agree.
My favorite movie is French Connection, so for all sorts of reasons.
I could
do 162 minutes on the French Connection by itself. The thing is, the only actor I could think of who would work now and he just quit is Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
Would be an actor I think would be up to being one of these parts, but he's a little too old now.
Yeah.
And he quit. But he's a guy who absolutely inhabits a part. So.
And what's tough is who the hell do you cast opposite him? Who's going to that's the thing. It's like when you put 95 De Niro against 95 Pacino, and especially when they sit down in that coffee shop, that's a tutorial on acting. That's like if you're a budding actor and you want to learn how to react and get into a flow with another person where it's really organic and it's really simple, it's not complexly, you know, in talking film language, there's not a lot of blocking, you know, that they have to do. Like it's just very basic. They're sitting at a chair. They're acting to one another, being able to get involved in the scene. And it's just like, who the hell do you put against one of those guys?
Yeah, though. There's a old thing in sports. It's a good problem.
Oh, it's isn't it? Yes.
If we get to that point, I'll be a very happy man.
I'll tell you this, Reed. Now, this is something that many people have asked me. So we're going to flip it around today and say, many people have said, Blake, are you going to keep going with this show? Like, you know, are you going to do more Michael Mann movie minutes? And I unequivocally have said, absolutely not. I'm not doing another Michael Mann minute podcast. But I did say this, and I will say it to you. If there is a Heat prequel novel, obviously there will be, and I'll read it and enjoy it. But if that Heat prequel novel, prequel sequel novel turns into a Heat prequel sequel film, then you bet your ass I will not hesitate, not for a second, to be unpacking, hopefully, your movie minute by minute, just as I have done with this show, because I feel like I would be obligated to be a completist and to cover every single minute of a heat prequel sequel in the spirit of this show.
Well, and I say that if I'm still walking the earth, I will be happy to be a guest on that.
You'll be back in a heartbeat. Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want to say a huge thank you to Reed Coleman. Reed, thank you so much for being a part of One Heat Minute. It's been an absolute blast.
Yeah, well, this was fun. Give me another minute.
They're running out.
No. I'll do the credits. it was great. I had a lot of fun. And if there's anything I can ever do for you, just let me know.
Look, I would just love as soon as there's a copy that I can get my hands on, an early copy of that book, you bet your sweet ass that I will read your great ass, Reed Coleman, that I will read the living daylights out of that book voraciously and be very grateful. But I just want to say a huge thank you to you guys. ReedColeman.com, you can go to his website and check that out. But otherwise, if you've got a phone and you've got the Kindle app or you've got Amazon or whatever the hell you do, his entire back catalog of insane, his insane back catalog of obviously Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone. I think there's 5 novels in the series so far that you've taken over, Reed. Is that right?
Yeah,
that
six is coming. There are 6 that I've written, and the 6th one is coming out in September.
He's obviously got his Mo Prager, Gus Murphy series, as well as a bunch of standalone novels, but 30 bestsellers, essentially.
Yes.
There's a lot to catch up on. So jump on that and do that quickly. Reed, thank you so much. We're going to stay in touch. Definitely. Thank you, Mr. Garth Franklin, for our web design, Mr. Paul Davies for our theme, and there's not many minutes to go, so we'll catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner of one of these random things at an airport.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.